Hi, good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. I'll be honest with you, I don't know what the hell's going on. But how are you? It's good to be here. I know you heard a long musical interlude. Usually it's trying to get the panelists that we have here into the studio, which is still the case. That's still
what. Light this one up.
Oh, they're going to make that one work? Okay, good. And then will you have a seat?
Yeah. Yeah,
okay. We're working on that. Excellent. How's Debbie? Everything good? Yeah. Okay, good. All right, so...
watch your back. Rob's got to get in there.
Good morning. Yeah, we're going to figure this out. We're going to get a chair. I'm Joe. let me talk to Alan for a minute, and then I'll introduce the panel once I know if everyone's who all is going to actually be on the panel this morning. Alan Chartok is with us. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. I'm fine. I'm getting smarter all the time. Sarah, who is sitting next to me, was giving me instructions on Judaism.
That's a stretch, but okay.
Oh my God! Okay. All right. What did you say when I sat down? You said, "How did you say what was going on?"
I said exactly that Alan is learning about Judaism from Sarah, the daughter of a Lutheran minister.
So this is what an idiot I am, because I'm like, why is Judy Patrick that hard to understand?
Oh, okay.
That's how dumb I am.
Judaisms.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I was like, how did that? Because I didn't think that Sarah would be teaching Alan about Judaism.
And what's the word, Sarah?
It's havruta.
Havruta.
Right.
And it means.
Hold on. Can I get your mic?
And it means.
Well, it's a process of studying the Torah with others.
Which you did.
I have.
With Rabbi
Matt Cutler. Matt Cutler. On occasion.
Yeah. That just—I have nothing but respect for you.
And for all I know, Judy Patrick may be coming in and being a panelist this morning. I don't know. So that's cool. Good morning, everyone. Welcome, Alan. Thank you for being here. Let me introduce the rest of the group. JP Miller joins us from the Empire Report. Hello, JP. How are you?
Hey, I'm good. Thank you for having me, Joe.
It's really nice to have you here. Always good. 2 days in a row, we get Sarah Rogerson with us. Of course, she is a Albany Law School professor. Not only that, but she is the director of the Immigration Law Clinic. Good morning, Sarah. How are you?
Good morning again.
Yes, very nice. 2 days in a row. We feel very lucky to have you here. Malcolm Nance is here. Good morning, Malcolm. How are you?
I'm fine. I feel like I just parachuted into the middle of your panel.
Did you know he was coming, Joe?
No. Our schedules are different. I think Malcolm's working on a different schedule, but
yeah,
that's okay. Oh,
I had to modify it from
last okay.
week.
That's okay. So, all good. And Mike Spain is here. Good morning, Mike. How are you?
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Very nice. Former associate editor of the Times Union. Okay, we are...
Who just mentioned that Harry Rosenfeld's funeral
story. Oh, that is so
Yeah, Harry Rosenfeld, a longtime editor at the Times Union, and prior to that, the Washington Post. He's being laid to rest today. A remarkable, remarkable guy. He passed away last week at the age of 91, almost 92. He led his famous connection, which I think made him a giant in journalism, is that he supervised the coverage of Woodward and Bernstein of the Watergate break-in, which broke many, many leads in the story that eventually led to the downfall of Richard Nixon. And then he came to Albany in 1978 and ran the Albany Hearst newspapers and continued after his retirement in the 90s to be part of the editorial board and write columns, and was even participating in that process at the beginning of last week. He just was a fighter to the end and a remarkable guy.
And he insisted in the Watergate situation, did he not, that Woodward and Bernstein keep the portfolio and keep going as opposed to giving it to the big boys on the national news desk.
Right. The pressure was to hand the story over because it involved the White House, to take it away from these two police reporters or city desk reporters and give it to the national writers. And he famously talked Ben Bradley into it. And in the movie, All the President's Men, he's portrayed by Jack Warden, where he basically says, these guys are hungry. They're on this story. They're going to do a good job, and he goes out and tells them using an expletive that they have the story and not to mess it up.
Yes. There you go.
And, it's another good word for mess.
Yes, right, exactly.
And in real life, did he utter such similar words?
He could on occasion, but he used it in a measured way.
But I meant as far as, it. I mean, is that essentially what happened in real life when dealing with the two reporters?
Those two reporters, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that was an accurate portrayal. It was right out of their own book.
The book.
Yeah. A remarkable guy. He was born in Berlin before the Holocaust, escaped, came to the Bronx and just became an American and was so, so proud of his American citizenship and such a defender of our freedom. And sometimes takes that perspective to see the value of what we have here.
Two incredible books, one about growing up, another one about his time as an editor, and both are fascinating, but we certainly send our condolences to the family and to his family of journalists who worked with him for so long. I read, was it Jay?
Jay Jochnowitz, the editorial page editor, had a really nice remembrance of Harry's involvement. Chris Churchill had a beautiful column about him.
Yeah. Casey Siler as well, yeah.
Casey's was really good.
Good tribute. Yeah. Some good,
they're all great reading.
Yes.
We all missed him a lot already. It's sad.
Good stuff. All right. Well, thank you all for being here. I appreciate it. Let's get started and talk about the stuff that we need to talk about this morning, and there is a lot of it. Let's see. I did send them, right?
And I don't read them, but you sent them.
Not to me.
Well, no, because I didn't know you were on the show, is why. All right, so let's talk about the virus headwinds hitting Wall Street after months of being fairly stable. This was a story that we talked about a little bit yesterday because it was happening as we spoke. And at some point yesterday, the Dow was down almost 800 points while we were on the air. Fear jolted the financial markets on Monday as investors realized that the path to global economic recovery after the pandemic would be anything but straightforward. For months, investors had been behaving as if they expected a full, smooth rebound from COVID crisis. But January through June, stocks rose 14%, one of the best first-half performances since the late 1990s. But the virus's potential to upend life all over again caught up with investors as a spate of worrying news, in particular new outbreaks involving the highly contagious Delta variant among unvaccinated people, led to a big sell-off on Monday. The S&P 500 stock market index had its worst decline since May, sliding more than 2% during the day before closing down 1.6%. The Dow fell 2.1%, its biggest one-day loss. Europe's stocks 600 fell 2.3%. So this is something that is being felt around the world. The impact on COVID on the stock market isn't over yet, according to Lori Calcevina, the head of U.S. equity strategy for RBC Capital Markets in New York. So there you go. What do we make of this? This story, I mean, I think I've said this many, many times on this program when we're talking about these stories about Wall Street. I don't understand what spooks investors, but, you know, we've known about the Delta variant for a while. We've known about inflation for a while. So what happened yesterday to make it just tank?
Well, I think that the stock market really does not like uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And there is growing uncertainty about the Delta variant. I think that the Delta variant for the last couple of weeks mm-hmm. has been something that people are looking at and nervous about. But we're now seeing increasing cases. I think this morning in the Capital Region, there was a headline in the Times Union saying that the cases in the Capital Region are up five times, 5x. And so I think the stock market's looking at this and investors are looking at this and saying, how is this going to affect how we go forward? Maybe hotel stocks are not as valuable as we thought they were. Maybe hotels won't rebound like we thought they were. Maybe airlines won't rebound like they thought they were. So it was focused on, although a lot of stocks were down. It was mostly focused on the tourism industry. And as soon as you get some momentum going downward halfway through the day, other people say, well, if it's going down, well, then I want to sell some too. Luckily, the market in pre-market right now is up, I think, 20 or so basis points. And hopefully it'll rebound. But I think that this is a harbinger for likely seeing more volatility in the stock market over the summer months as this Delta variant takes hold. And as we, you know, if you see California or New York start to implement mask mandates and talk about restrictions, there will definitely be repercussions in the market.
Well, we're already seeing that in Los Angeles. And, well, the sheriff doesn't say, but everyone else mm-hmm. believes that that's the case. And so, yes, if it were to happen in New York or another major metropolitan center, what I don't quite understand, though, is then how does, like at the end of the day, everyone's like, oh, okay, it's all better now.
Well, we have learned, right, guys, that we have learned that what used to be considered to be horrendous, you know, an 800-point drop one time. I remember that. It was as if the world had ended. That's not the case anymore. Everybody says, ho-hum, you know, it'll be all right tomorrow. And already, you know, a couple hundred points come back. And the market is still doing extremely well, except that our controller here at WMC, the magnificent Jordan Yoxall, sends out a little thing every morning with where our accounts stand. And this morning, not so good.
Well,
not so good. It makes me nervous.
I also think you have to look at it in context. It was a significant single day drop, but the market has been screaming since last spring when it went down significantly. And so down 2%, of course, people don't want a down 2% market. But in context, the market is still up on the year. It's still up significantly since last spring.
Well, and certain sectors gained, right? Again, mm-hmm. we saw like an up in Etsy, and I immediately thought, are people crafting again? But it was the face masks.
Oh, face masks.
Because homemade face masks were...
They're all the rage. Yeah,
right.
That and puzzles.
Yeah.
Kimberly Clark, which makes toilet paper, was also up yesterday.
Yep.
Yeah.
Malcolm, you were nodding. Anything you'd like to add to that?
No, I think all of these are very salient points. And like you said, last year, there's a big difference between a tiny little dip yesterday and the crash we had last year. So, you know, we have to look at it in perspective. And let me tell you something. I just came back from several weeks over in Europe. The Delta variant is not a joke. They're taking it seriously over there, even though they're quietly opening up. But the places where it's most prevalent are England and other points where people came from the Indian subcontinent before they shut travel down from the Indian subcontinent. And I know that I was, I actually tried to get through to Gibraltar just to go over for a day. That's England as far as Europe's concerned. And they were like, there's no way you're going in there because that's Delta variant country. And they're deathly afraid that it's really going to explode in Europe and they're going to have to go back to their shutdowns and everything. Same here. The places where we know these variants are taking off are the places that don't believe in coronavirus. And what do they say? 98.8% of all deaths are unvaccinated people. So they're, you know, I think St. Louis, is that where the, mm-hmm. the big
Missouri?
Missouri. I recall Missouri literally thumbing their nose at the entire thing. I wouldn't be surprised if Iowa, you know, goes down in a blaze of glory again. They just don't believe this thing's true. It's politics and it's literally killing their constituents.
You know, one of the things, Mike, about the UK is that yesterday was supposed to be Freedom Day. I guess it was Freedom Day. They still called it that, and they lifted the mandates, and yet the numbers are really bad. The prime minister is in quarantine, and meanwhile, in the United States, they're warning people traveling to the UK.
Yeah, I, as Malcolm said, I think that they take it seriously and they're taking the necessary steps. So the image on Freedom Day coming out of the UK is Boris Johnson wearing a mask. You know, it's still, this is not over, folks, and we have to take it seriously. And but I guess, you know, you try to follow the science, but it's we're getting a little bit of confusion about why people who are vaccinated need to wear masks, but I guess because, as we've learned from the Olympics and some of the athletes, you can still get it after you've been vaccinated.
And we still don't really have an answer to that question of if you can pass it too.
Right.
And also the concern, which very little is known, but what other variants are out there or being created, especially in these areas in the southern part of the United States and other parts of the world where there are so many unvaccinated people.
They're actually talking about a Lambda variant that's out there now.
Yeah.
It's a new, more virulent version of Delta. I mean, it's you know, the virus is a thing. How can I put it? It's the ultimate Mother Nature's weapon. It is changing itself to go after the thing that it wants most, which is a human host.
So as
kill
the
it.
Ultimate spy.
We have 20 seconds.
How did it start?
In 20 seconds.
The Earth is more than capable of doing things to us, you know, so we don't have to go around making things. So it's natural.
All right, we'll take a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation. Alan Chartok, J.P. Miller, Sarah Rogerson, Malcolm Nance, and Mike Spain. We will continue our conversation. We welcome your input, panel at WAMC.org. We will be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We've been talking about the Delta variant, which we'll continue to talk about. Also making news while we are speaking is the fact that Jeff Bezos blasted into space Tuesday. I believe it was an 11-minute flight. It has landed in Texas, in Van Horn, Texas, and the three occupants of the craft are just emerging now. It is his brother. There's also an 18-year-old from the Netherlands and an 82-year-old aviation pioneer from Texas who are on board, in addition to Jeff Bezos, of course, of Amazon fame. So we'll probably be talking about that more, but I just wanted to let you know that that was happening as we were speaking as well. So let's go back to the Delta variant and what we make of this. The letters are coming in on this subject. And William says, the question for me is, do Republicans need to see large numbers of their cohort start dying before they take it seriously? Will it take the tragic death of a growing number of children or enough children in Republican states and districts before the idea of vaccination and masks are accepted? Where is the tipping point? It seems to me that the increasing likelihood of new variants and their impact on the unvaccinated may be the only thing that shifts the tide or not.
Depends on what Trump says. I mean, you know, if he puts the word in that we're not going to, you know, do anything to mitigate this, then, you know, anything could happen.
Well, politically, isn't it something that the Trumpers or the Republicans who support Trump want to see? They want to see the economy go sour, and they want to see chaos during the Biden administration. It's advantageous. They can blame it all on Biden that way when the midterms roll around next year.
Sarah?
It seems like a self-defeating prophecy, but I think you're right. Or not prophecy, but a self-defeating strategy. And it's not just children, right? It's vulnerable people among us, and it's vulnerable relatives of those people who ascribe to that same mentality that Mike is describing. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if they lose loved ones. And if they do, then they can blame it on Biden. It's perplexing.
JP?
I thought it was significant that White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki yesterday said that they would welcome a public service announcement from President Trump. And I guess I'm not amazed, but Trump has a huge opportunity right now to go to those places in person, and he could hold a rally, and they could be doing vaccines there. And I bet Joe Biden would join hands with Trump in trying to get people to get vaccinated in those places where Trump is popular. Mm-hmm. But he refuses to do anything about it. You're seeing Fox News. There was a story this morning that Fox News has a vaccine program at their a vaccine passport program in their office while their talking heads are bringing into question the vaccine. So it's a crazy thing that that there isn't more encouragement from that side of the aisle to get their people to be vaccinated. It's an amazing phenomenon.
I mean, Malcolm, we were talking about this yesterday on the show, but when you look at it, I mean, no matter what measure you use, fully vaccinated, we're somewhere around 50%. And that means half the population isn't vaccinated, which, I don't know, that doesn't just seem that great to me.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's knocking down the virus in major urban areas and in major states, even though we're seeing that little flash out in California. But we can clearly quantify now by the people who are dying that if you are not vaccinated and you get this thing, you are going to die or be incapacitated. I was reading something yesterday, a couple of comments from a woman who said that she actually has a form of neuropathy that comes from this, you know, 6 months after she had COVID. Then, this is interesting, once she got vaccinated, it went away. This is for our own good. I served in the armed forces for 20 years, you guys know that, and way back in the day, when I went through boot camp, the first thing they did was they put you all in line. They made you lift your left shoulder, and they gave you, you know, the five different types of shot, measles, mumps, rubella, plus. And then they actually literally gave us long stainless steel syringes full of penicillin, just in case we had any other types of diseases that were unmentionable, just to clear it up. There was no asking if we wanted to do this, right? This was mandatory for the health of the force. We're having now, because the FDA hasn't fully approved it, people who are saying they're in the armed forces, they're not going to take this thing. Look, I was given experimental drugs in the first Gulf War that probably caused Gulf War syndrome. You know, I was smart enough not to take them because we didn't find any chemical weapons, so why take it? But the point is that there is something here now, people.
Anyone else have that experience on the panel?
No.
Okay, just checking.
You know, but there is something here, and it's killing people. But we have a class of politician now. And you know, I really wish Trump could say something. He won't. His ego won't allow him to help other people. He's a sociopath.
No, his politics won't.
His ego is his politics.
Well, okay.
You know, yeah. I mean, and right now, he went and had his vaccine secretly in January.
In January, yeah.
Right? And so did virtually everybody else. Sean Hannity last night came on television with a disclaimer that clearly came from the Fox News legal office, which if you watch it is hilarious, saying, you know, this is serious, this is real, get vaccinated, and then went on and brought a woman in claiming that she had been, received a disease from taking a vaccine. Well, they didn't tell her that that was a completely different vaccine and a completely different disease that she had had genetically. It's laughable what's happening out there, but it's killing our neighbors. So go get vaccinated, for God's sake.
The one thing that I don't agree with you on this, okay, Malcolm, is I don't think it's laughable. You know, you say it's laughable. To make your point, all of these people who are not taking it are at great risk. We know that 96% of the people who have developed the disease are unvaccinated. It's incredible. And still, they won't move.
And where are they getting their information from? You know, I was really impressed that Joe Biden called out Facebook this weekend. Mm-hmm. That they, you know, Facebook, when Facebook finds out that you are questioning the vaccine, they push and push and push anti-vaccine messages into your phone so that you keep reading and keep reading. They had an article on Robert F. Kennedy Jr. today, so it's not just the right. I know it's the vast majority is Trump and Fox News pushing this, but Facebook needs to somehow be held to account for pushing this stuff.
The part of that story that amused me was after Biden made that accusation over the weekend, the head of ethical standards at Facebook came out in response. That to me is very funny.
Well, and I think what
they have one.
And what they said was, we find it hilarious that they're critiquing us when just last week privately they praised us for our efforts to get out positive information. Maybe it was a different article that I read, but like, you know, that's not an effective response from a company that we know. I think they're just having a hard time tweaking the algorithm, and they don't want to take responsibility for it because that's what it all is. It's
an ATM. It's money. They're not going to. Tweaking the algorithm means that they hemorrhage cash.
Yeah.
So, you know, the way that they work hand in hand with the government of China to turn over people and to suppress freedom of speech, they're working hand in hand with people that are making them an enormous quantity of money. And they're not going to do it for the good of America. They're a business. They are the modern version of the tobacco industry. But now it's disinformation that sells, and misinformation moves their algorithm.
100%.
I mean, I've been studying this. Certainly, I've written 4 books now, and you know, 3 of which were now 4 that are about how their disinformation networks propagate, you know, actually radicalize people who are out to kill other Americans, Americans who are killing other Americans. If there's another Oklahoma City, Facebook won't take any responsibility for it whatsoever. They'll just say, oh, well, we took him off our platform. Yeah, well, I saw a mass murder committed on Facebook live stream a couple of years ago from New Zealand, live.
Let me get to this letter, and then we'll take a break, and we'll continue our conversation with our panel here. Robert writes, the stock market is of little consequence. It rises and falls like the sea. What trumps all that is the realignment of the weather patterns earthwide. The multiple fronts and forms of destruction coming will shut the Republicans down. We must hold on to our hats and push for a green solution while the band plays on.
Good letter.
Yeah. Good, a good depressing letter.
We haven't even talked about climate change and the deniers of that.
All right, we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. Alan Chartok, Sarah Rogerson, J.P. Miller, Malcolm Nance, and Mike Spain. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel conversation. Alan Chartok, Sarah Rogerson, J.P. Miller, Malcolm Nance, and Mike Spain. Good morning, all, and we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. This letter from Barb. My 19-year-old daughter actually has gotten COVID twice prior to being vaccinated, last July and then again last December. The kid, who truly is never sick, is a long hauler, heart palpitations, shortness of breath, and an array of neurological symptoms. I tell everyone her story in hopes they'll get vaccinated. Most shrug and assume I'm leaving out some detail about pre-existing conditions. She's angry, and we share her frustrations. Well, we certainly hope your daughter is on the mend and better and can overcome this and, for God's sakes, doesn't get it again. Good morning from Joel. Malcolm Nance is right. Trump's ego is his politics. They are one and the same, says Joel. All right, let's move on to other topics this morning, and we'll stay somewhat on the issue of COVID by talking about what fully vaccinated U.S. citizens can do. And as of August 9th, that means you can go to Canada. Canada is looking to open its border. This has been an issue for quite some time, a lot of political back and forth on this. Canada on Monday said it will begin to ease pandemic restrictions at the U.S.-Canada border next month, allowing U.S. citizens and permanent residents living in the United States who are fully vaccinated with Canadian authorized vaccinations to enter for non-essential travel without quarantining. The decision, which takes effect August 9th, follows months of criticism from U.S. lawmakers across the political spectrum, business groups, and some travelers over what they have said was an overly cautious approach to lifting curbs that have split families, battered the tourism sector, and upended life in a close-knit border community. To be eligible for entry, fully vaccinated U.S. citizens and permanent residents must be asymptomatic and present a negative coronavirus molecular test taken within 72 hours of flight departure or arrival at a land crossing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll jump in on that. My late wife was from Montreal. She was Quebecois. And the fact that I ended up where I am in the Albany area is because we bought a home that was equidistant between Montreal and Philadelphia. It's been very hard on my daughter, who hasn't been able to see her grandmother, her aunts, and all the rest there. Even though she's a Canadian citizen, if she had flown from Albany to New York and up there, she would have had to have quarantined in a government hotel for 14 days, and they only just lifted that restriction. Now you have to have a PCR test to cross that border up there, even though we have Nexus and could just zoom across. But you know what? It's a good thing. There's a. I know you all miss those Canadian, RVs going down.
North of Florida,
right down the 87, hundreds of trucks, going hundreds
of miles an hour.
yeah, they're not good with the driving up there.
Yeah, it's a broad brush.
So long as there's not a moose in the road, these guys,
I want to offer up a contrast to the southern border because I never want to pass up an opportunity to remind everyone that we think very differently about our northern border than we do our southern border for very arbitrary reasons, most of which have to do with the color of the skin of the people who are transversing those borders. And I just want to remind everyone that the last administration, our vice president overruled CDC guidance and shut down our southern border. We're still dealing with the effects of that based on phony health concerns regarding the transmission of COVID. And just last week, their disciple in Texas, Senator Ted Cruz, continued to blame migrants for the spread of the disease. But he didn't talk about Canada. He only talked about the southern border.
Where he was born.
Yeah, he was born in Canada, right?
Right.
Here's the kicker. Wasn't he just going to Cancun a few weeks
ago?
Yeah,
exactly.
Isn't that the southern border?
It is. It's on the other side of that border. So, and he left in the middle of a climate crisis in his own state that his own constituents were suffering through. So, just lift that up for the group.
And it probably will always be that way, sadly, right?
Always. Well, yeah. I hope not, but yeah. I mean, the way, if you look at historical migration patterns, it was that way for my ancestors who actually migrated from England, left poverty in England to Ireland right before the potato famine hit, and the potato famine hit, and they migrated to Canada, and then from Canada down through Michigan, and that was fraught, and Irish and Italian migrants have suffered. It was the Irish in Albany that were originally the settlers of the neighborhoods that were subject to redlining 100 years ago.
Right.
So. I don't know who the next target will be after our southern neighbors, but it's always someone.
Well, these migration patterns also showed that older Americans went down south to places like Phoenix and Florida. And if these migration patterns hold and climate change keeps battering us, they may be moving to Panama or Nicaragua soon, the snowbirds. Because I'll tell you, it's tough out in the West, man. They are literally at their lowest levels of water in history. And I don't know how cities like Phoenix are going to continue to exist. I mean, it's a great place. The Saudis love to live there. But I don't know how these giant metropolises that require water. And, Hoover Dam has got the lowest levels of water that it has. Lake Mead is like ready to dry up. We are in serious trouble climate-wise.
Anyone else on that?
I go to Canada every summer until last summer. I love Canada, and I was personally, outraged that Trudeau shut down the border. But then I talked to my family in Canada, and they seem to be okay with it. And it's interesting to see how Canadians. It seemed like Americans were more outraged by the border shutdown than Canadians.
Yes.
Just from my.
Well, aren't Americans outraged about everything more than Canadians?
Yes. it's just fascinating because
they're a mellow lot.
Yeah, they are, and their economy is certainly very intertwined with America. I think something like 90% of Canadians live within 150 miles of the U.S. border. Mm-hmm. So, I'm also kind of surprised that. With the increase in the Delta variant, Trudeau is choosing now to open the border on August 9th. He's not getting the full tourist season. Why not wait until after Labor Day? Americans
to do anticipate that 70% or more of Canadians will be fully vaccinated by that time.
Right.
When you subtract children who are ineligible for the vaccine from it, that's just about all the adults.
There's herd immunity.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, don't forget that Canada only has a population of about 20 million people, the population of New York and Chicago. So in spread out across a country the size of the larger than the United States. So us going up there with, as we now see, horribly irresponsible people and bringing in variants and virus is one thing. And they're not, you know, the same precaution. You know, you could also say that I just flew back from Europe. Here, they're giving the same precautions. I had to show my vaccine record. Then I had to get a PCR, not a rapid test, a PCR test 72 hours before arriving in New York City. So why shouldn't Canada do the same thing? They are a different country, you know.
Karen writes to us and says, when I was growing up living partly in Europe, to come home to the United States, I had to show my yellow pass with my passport that had been vaccinated. I think it was for smallpox and maybe a yellow fever. That is Karen's experience. We go
vaccination card.
Another Karen, this one with an E and an I. My grandson is in the Army National Guard Reserve for his fourth year, was guarding the Capitol during the inauguration day, slept in the Capitol floor, yet the Army has not vaccinated these troops for COVID. Why? In our family, 76 to 12 years old, so the break is from 12 to 76, mm-hmm. have all had both vaccinations, but not him.
He can walk into any military treatment center and get vaccinated this morning. So slap him upside the head, say, soldier, get over there. Next time you're on drill, get over there and get your vaccine or don't even come into the house.
This about the story on space. From Anne, the rah-rah tone of most media coverage on Bezos's and Branson's space tourism rocket launches is shoddy journalism. Why? This is not reporting. We are in the middle of a climate catastrophe. Reporters should be asking how much did their launches and will their future for-profit launches accelerate the floods, fires, record unbelievable heat waves, extinctions, crop failures, water shortages, and other existential threats. And, adds Anne, are governments requiring Bezos and Branson to pay a significant percentage of their profits to help fight climate change that they're aggravating?
Profits, pay, taxes. No.
We're not laughing at you, Karen. We're laughing
at
with you.
At the thought of them
or
actually
crying,
paying
whatever
taxes.
It is. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know what... I mean, I know this is always brought up, but I think she brings up an interesting point. Just while we were sitting here, all the major networks were looking at this. And there is a rah-rah aspect to this because you know, we send stuff up all the time, and yet because these guys are millionaires and billionaires and whatever else, whatever higher than that.
Multi-billionaires.
Gazillionaires. that they're being followed and being watched. And I don't know, because it does, it's going to affect their bottom line, right? I mean, isn't that the whole point of for this to be travel for rich people, right?
Yeah.
Well, I think part of the appeal is that it's planning up, they're ordinary people. They're not scientists. You don't have to be an astronaut anymore to go to space, right? You don't have to go through years and years of rigorous training.
You can buy your way into a rocket.
And there's some risk, I think. It's different than taking a commercial flight or riding a motorcycle or riding a helicopter. Probably more risk than any of those things to go into space.
Even motorcycle?
but they developed it and they want to do it and they know that there is a market for it. So by doing it, they are helping the bottom line, right? And yeah. We are also the media is complicit in that and saying, see how much fun. If you had the cash, you could do this too.
Right. So here are the richest guys in the world forgetting. Well, maybe some of us are forgetting my ultimate feeling about all of this, which is that God has term limits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Right. But before you go, you can go to space, unless going to space is part of
the term
you
limit.
Going. Yeah,
that's how you reach your term limit.
I know. I watched Jeff Bezos and the Virgin Galactic launches with a very Formula One Indy 500 sort of aspect. So look, checking the walls to see who's going to bounce off of it. But, you know, I mean, rich people went out on the Titanic too.
Well, that's a very, very good point. Mm-hmm. You make a good point. I did this the last time we were talking about the subject, I believe, when Richard Branson went up, and we just went around the room real quick. But would anybody go on? Would anybody
go on any of these?
Go on space? Yeah. Anyone?
Not me.
I would go in space, but I mean, I think you got to earn it. I think you have to go through astronaut training. You can put up $500 million and go through the Russian space program. I think they had a woman billionaire from the Emirates, if I'm not mistaken, who did that and went to the space station and go do something useful, right? You want to be an astronaut? You want to earn the wings? Go learn how to fly a jet. Go do all the other things that real astronauts have to do. Going up and just going up for 30 seconds, being weightless, coming down. Nah, you don't get any wings for that.
Well, there'll be some people who say, Malcolm, under that formula, nobody should fly in a plane without, you know, having taken flying lessons and doing all
as
that.
As a passenger?
I think the whole point here is to show, maybe I'm wrong, that you can without.
That there's a normality.
Passengers are passengers. They're not the pilots. This is 1903 equivalent of hanging on the wings of the Wright flyer.
Well, I think that these Branson and Bezos look at themselves as visionaries and as pioneers, and that in 50 or 100 years there's going to be entire colonies of humans and marketplaces and all sorts of stuff going up in space, and mm-hmm. that they of course are not Buzz Aldrin and, you know, they're not the first people to walk on the moon, but they are trying to bring about more acceptance of going into space and creating more of a market up there.
And Mike, what were we just saying? What was more than billion? What was it?
Well, I was saying multi-billion gazillion.
So, all right, so we're getting a gazillion letters about the population of Canada. It's 38 million.
Oh, okay. You know, that's still 2 million less than African Americans in the United States.
Mm. All right. There we go.
40 million of us.
We'll correct the population.
Thank you, Canadian population counters.
A lot of people who are writing are also on the Vermont border, just saying. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. Alan Chartok, Sarah Rogerson, J.P. Miller, Malcolm Nance, and Mike Spain. We welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this morning. Alan Chartok, Sarah Rogerson. We also have with us J.P. Miller, Malcolm Nance, and Mike Spain. We welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. Let's move on to other issues. Let us talk about Haiti. Haiti's acting Prime Minister Claude Joseph says he will step down amid a leadership dispute. This is the latest news from Haiti, Claude Joseph, who has normally led Haiti as acting Prime Minister since the nominally, my apologies, mm-hmm. led Haiti as acting Prime Minister since the assassination of the president, has agreed to step down and hand over power to challenger Ariel Henry, who has been backed by the international community. The agreement ends a power struggle between two men appointed by the former president, who had been courting support internationally and domestically for their rival claims as Haiti's interim leader. It aimed at defusing a political crisis that has left the troubled Caribbean nation rudderless since the July 7th assassination.
I want to ask Malcolm, just who told who to do what?
I don't know. Have any of you been to Haiti? I've been to Haiti. Boy, you do not want a crisis in that country, all right? I mean, it is like stuffing 10 families into a single bedroom house and then turning off the heat and breaking the refrigerator. It is just one of those places where you have all these rival clans. There's as in most places in the Caribbean, there's a historic families that have a lot of money. Many of them have deep links to the Haitian community in Florida. And that's where this plot to kill the president came from. The question that they're going to have to resolve, no matter who the interim president is how did all these mercenaries get past the 100 bodyguards and into the house of the president pretending to be the Drug Enforcement Administration, who have no authority down there, right? This story is going to get interesting. But now that this gives us a measure of stability in Haiti, we can start asking some serious questions. And for those of you who say, well, what does this have to do with me? Less than a week ago, we were talking about sending U.S. forces down to Haiti to stabilize that country. So we don't want to get into a situation where we're going to have to start nation building again. I mean, after the earthquake, which devastated that country and killed tens of thousands, I think hundreds of thousands, we really need to make sure that we have a stable country in Haiti so that we don't have 100,000 people jumping onto boats tomorrow.
Which brings up the question of U.S. role. Right. You say we have to. What have we been doing up until now, and how much are our fingerprints on this thing?
Well, I mean, the U.S. government has been working along with the international community to reconstruct Haiti. But, you know, the way that we do that is through USAID and non-governmental organizations. So we've been chucking lots of money at them. With the lead is the World Health Organization, the World Food Organization, the big organizations from the United Nations. But, you know, we have our fingerprints there. But we, you know, but then again, we're talking about a country where people actually believe on the far right that Hillary Clinton was, you know, stealing children from Haiti for their blood. So, you know, it's one of those things that doesn't come up. But interesting fact, there was really big Trump support in the Haitian community in Florida because, you know, the business acumen thing and you know, making right. money off of it somehow. But they're a big community that you don't hear much about.
Alan asked about U.S. involvement, but I'm also curious as to the U.S. connections to the assassins.
Yeah, that's a very, very interesting question. The two U.S. citizens that were captured were Haitian Americans who were U.S. passport holders. The Colombians and Venezuelans that they captured were contractors. And let me tell you something. So I lived in the United Arab Emirates for 10 years. And while I was there, Eric Prince, the leader of Blackwater, was there a lot. And I used to see Eric. We would run down the Corniche to, you know, from time to time. And I knew him when he was in the Navy at one point. And he had done an interesting deal. He had taken all the Nepali bodyguards and gate guards all around the nation and had gotten that contract broken and had replaced them all with Colombian army mercenaries. So the Arab oil sheikhs of the United Arab Emirates are all being protected by Catholic Colombian mercenaries.
Trained by the U.S., probably.
Yes. That and all of them had to be either police or paramilitary. And Eric Prince bought them all into that country. So when you hear me say, somebody comes up and says, hey, Colombian mercenaries stormed stormed the house of the president of Haiti, my mind's going to go to a subsidiary of that. And I'm certain somewhere off in the distance, we're going to find some link. Prince believes in a global mercenary elite. And I've run into him in Libya, people coming up and saying, you know, oh, we've got these Americans here and they want to take over all, you know, anti-drug and anti-human trafficking across the Mediterranean. I go, it's Eric Prince. And he runs the largest security training center in China. So there's
and
your
let's
man.
Be, let's be clear. He's getting contracts from the Department of Defense, the Department of Homeland Security. There's been a lot of American money flowing to his companies for these
U.S.
purposes.
Government money.
U.S. government money. And the last time I checked, the amount of U.S. aid dollars that constitute the percentage of U.S. aid dollars in our overall budget is like less than 3%.
Yes.
For the entire world. Not
most Americans have no idea.
Oh, they think it's
that
like 80% of the
all.
Budget.
Because right. when 100%. I worked in Congress, my job was to send out the questionnaire.
3% of the U.S. budget, that's a lot of money though, no?
It is, but well, like think about that. But the money that we pump in the Department of Homeland Security, which has the largest budget share, right? And that's where some of these sure. Eric Prince dollars are compared to the tiny little slice of USA dollars that we're giving. And Eric Prince is working. I shouldn't put him on trial on the radio, but the United States government working through different actors is destabilizing these countries and then providing them pennies to help reconstruct their failed states.
I'll tell you what, his comeuppance is due. I mean, he was deeply involved in the Trump-Russia scandal. You know, he was meeting with Russian oligarchs out in the Seychelles and the Maldives, flying out of Abu Dhabi, you know. And, you know, his day is coming. He will be held accountable at some point.
How is the press in Haiti? As we read stories, do we believe what is reported? And how confident are you that the people that they've apprehended are the actual assassins?
Mm. Yeah, the people who they apprehended are the actual assassins. And this is a crazy story. So these two American citizens, it turns out, were formerly informants for the Drug Enforcement Administration. And they went to another foreign embassy, I think it was the embassy of Taiwan, and tried to get asylum there. Because now, first off, you shoot a gun in Haiti, 400 dogs start barking. That's the first thing that happens. Then everyone and their dog comes outside and takes a look at you. So these guys are running with heavy weapons throughout the street, and they hole up there. They hit the embassy, turns them over, and one of them calls the DEA, and there are phone calls that have been recorded by them saying, hey, I need help to get out of here. They're thinking it's a Tom Clancy movie, and we're going to fly people in to get them out. No, the DEA officer said, turn yourself in. That's the only thing that's going to save you here. It's going to be a great movie.
Sorry, one more question. What was their motive for killing him?
No, I just need one more question.
Write it all down. Tom Cruise can play the head of the mercenaries. Well, apparently it was to overthrow the government to put this Haitian businessman in power, but I don't understand it. I mean, you know, Haiti's a labyrinthine, because things that we think that would happen on an international scale happen on the street corner scale there. It really does.
We have letters, but none of them are about this subject.
Oh.
Jade writes, they're all about the rockets and the billionaires. So Jade writes, the discussion you had reminds me of an old saying, if you can send a man to the moon, why not send them all? Of course, I wouldn't send them all, but I would have a red list of those I'd like to see go first, says Jade. Very nice.
Good letter, Jade.
Dwayne says, so the folks who were screaming that you can't close the economy or force people to wear masks are now putting the economic recovery at risk due to not getting a vaccine. Maybe the economic argument might persuade some people to get the vaccine. Then we have this from Chris on space and pollution. While space launch facilities are not exactly green, rockets using liquid hydrogen or liquid oxygen, the byproduct of burn that is water. We can rah-rah this as making future launches cheaper, increasing the reusability of launch vehicles, etc. That from Chris. All right, let's go to this story for a moment. We have about 10 minutes before the break, and I would like to talk about January 6th and the assault on the U.S. Capitol. We have seen a U.S. Capitol rioter has been sentenced, the first to have been sentenced to a felony in federal prison. He has been sentenced to 8 months and 2 years of supervised release. The sentencing is the first in a felony case stemming from the deadly January 6th assault on the U.S. Capitol by a mob of Trump supporters. Alan.
Listen carefully, because this is what happened here. That's called a slap on the hand. It's nothing. The Constitution of the United States was brought into grave danger. We know who sent them down there. We know how it happened. The idea that, you know, you're going to send a signal to all of these thousands of people who showed up by saying 18 months in the can is really ludicrous.
I think it's noteworthy that the judge, and he was very firm in his statements to the defendant before sentencing, and how the person was trying to undermine the Constitution and the free election. I mean, he put that all on the record. He was a judge that was appointed to the federal bench by Donald Trump. So if it's a taste of what's going to happen, there's going to be a lot of people going to jail. And this guy's role was, he got on the Senate floor, so he was one of the more serious ones. And, you know, I think this is going to cause a ripple reaction across the country as more of these guys get sentenced. And in their sentencing, session, you know, in court, this guy was contrite, apologized, acknowledged what he did.
Well, the lawyer wrote him a good statement.
Yeah, well, the lawyer himself was kind of a nut job. He was trying to connect it. He was trying to connect it to, you know, the civil unrest that happened in Portland, Oregon, or maybe in St. Louis or something like that. And the judge wouldn't let him. He said, "This is entirely different, entirely separate, entirely." And I think that these affirmations coming from the bench are important.
Yeah, but still, the
government
sanction,
only asked for 18 months.
Well, and then he didn't get anything
eight,
like
right?
it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Sarah?
I'm not a fan, as I said yesterday, of carceral justice and putting people away. The putting people's bodies away for doing bad things.
Yeah, okay, I got it now.
But
for what? For
Khalif,
what?
For crime.
Okay, for crime. Okay.
But Khalif Browder went to Rikers at the age of 16 for being accused of stealing a backpack, and he died there.
Yeah.
3 years. For the accusation of a backpack. We have a white man who broke into our Capitol, and it's striking the different treatment and outcomes.
Amen.
Yeah.
I cannot. It's the symbolism of that, and I'm not urging, lock him up and throw away the key, but it's a sign of how urgent we feel this problem is. And if we don't feel the urgency of this problem for our democracy, we're done.
Well, to Mike's point about even 18 months, I mean, just doesn't seem, even Alan says slap on the wrist, but that doesn't seem like anything.
3 years for the accusation of stealing a backpack for a 16-year-old boy, black boy.
I think he got forgotten, though, right?
Yeah, he never.
He was never arraigned.
Yeah, he was just, right. Yeah, never even.
Even
got
worse.
His,
I know.
His case never, now posthumously makes it to the New York Times on occasion when we remember. But it's disgusting. The gulf between the two still in 2021.
So will different judges have different sentences for these individuals? And I mean, will you see a curve?
There will be.
Probably, yeah. Yeah, there's different, and it depends, there's different sentencing, different charges against the...
Well, let me speak up for carceral justice here.
Oh, right. Oh, boy.
This corner, speaking on behalf of carceral justice.
A big fan of chucking them in the hoosegow. So, first off, I'm not going to apologize for this idiot, because you guys know I am very deeply involved in this. Last November 6th on Bill Maher's show, Real Time with Bill Maher, I predicted that we would be having an insurgency. And over the next 60 days when I was on MSNBC, I was calling this an insurgency because it was a political warfare operation plus the potential for insurrection. And it happened. Now we're going into a possibly generational series of insurgencies. So I'm all for throwing the book at the guy to deter any future behaviors. However, this guy only walked into the building. So 8 months, I don't care about that. Here's what I like. He's a convicted felon now. He loses his right in many cases to vote, although I don't think that's the greatest thing. Mm-mm. But he never can own a firearm again. Any that he have Legally. Have to be surrendered, right? And this is, I'm a gun owner. I know these guys. I come from that culture, although I don't sit around in my bed and caress them all day and name them Shirley.
Well, that paints a picture.
Yeah, well, not me. I run it like the military. Part. But these guys, this is death for them. Removing their right to own a firearm for many of these people is the equivalent to death. And now that will have a greater deterrent effect than anything else we could do to them. Sending them to prison. Now, I'm looking for the people who have 8 and 9 counts against them. The people who have conspiracy counts, these Oath Keepers. Hey, if you guys are around here in the Oath Keepers, be prepared. They're going to get designated like other groups as domestic terrorist organizations. Proud Boys, who are still recruiting out there, they've been designated by two countries as a terrorist organization. Those people have the hammer coming at them. And that's where you're going to start seeing 3, 4, 5, 6 years. And it's going to have to work its way up to the politicians and the influencers. I'm looking at you, Roger Stone, who may have had some hand in this. But we have to let the Justice Department suss out the conspiracies.
All right, so let's talk about this working its way up. I mean, what we know now as far as the investigation goes, the GOP members of the panel investigating the January 6th insurrection have been named by Kevin McCarthy. Jim Jordan is one of the five who will be serving on that panel, along with the Rodney Davis, Jim Banks, Troy Nels, and Kelly Armstrong. So we do have on the other side, even though a Republican, we do have Liz Cheney. So what do you think? What's going to come out of that?
You looking at me?
Well, I'll look at whoever's going to give me an answer.
They're going to be mouthpieces, as we have seen in previous appearances, and they will take the Trumpian Republican line, particularly Jordan, who we know, based on his performance up to now, does it, and from their perspective, does it well. But that's what we're going to see. Mm.
Even from Cheney, you think?
No, I don't think from Cheney. Three of the five appointed voted against certifying the election. So that's like saying we want 9/11 hijackers on the 9/11 investigation.
Right. Yeah.
No, these guys, Nancy Pelosi has the authority to veto whoever goes on that panel. And she should do it today, and she should be very clear that I won't accept anyone that decided that they would subvert the Constitution of the United States attempting to investigate themselves.
So how many of those does it get rid of?
Three.
We get rid of three, including Jordan. In fact, there's some speculation that Jordan will be the first to get thrown out by Pelosi.
Yeah. So what does this ultimately... Mike, I thought you were going to say something on this as far as where this gets us in the investigation and how this fits in to finding justice for what happened that day.
Well, it's separate from the Justice Department investigation.
Of course,
yeah. This is to expose what led up to this, what factors were in it, who is responsible. And the Republican appointees, McCarthy's appointees to this panel are going to fight that every step of the way. They're going to try to link the violence that happened on January 6th to some violence, in Minneapolis or Portland or other places around the country, and they're going to muddy the water as much as they can, and they're going to, it could backfire. It could backfire on the Democrats, too, if these guys are effective in, just confusing people. And that's different from what's going on with the Justice Department when they start to some of these guys are not pleading guilty. Some of these insurgents from January 6th are not pleading guilty. It's going to mean trials and an introduction of evidence into the courts and onto the record about that is going to be very damaging, I think. And it's going to show how this was a conspiracy to overthrow the government and change the election.
John writes to us and says, this is dangerous. Once this guy is out of jail, Trump will hail him as a hero.
No, he won't. He turned on Trump. So he'll
never be held as
a hero unless he comes back and says, I didn't mean any of it.
Steve says 8 months is ridiculous. He should have been charged with and prosecuted for felony murder. Same with all of the other jerks. Then there is this letter from Clarence. I'm concerned that many members of Trump's cabinet were involved with the planning of the 1-6 insurrection. I think his lack of knowledge of government did not give him the ability to do the planning. The cabinet, need to be held accountable. The investigation, an investigation, is required. Anyone on that? Hearing none, we will pause and we will take a break. When we come back, we'll have our last go-round with our panel. We have a great one today. Alan Chartok, Sarah Rogerson, J.P. Miller, Malcolm Nance, and Mike Spain. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. I got a little note from Sarah LeDuc pleading with letter writers to keep them short. She said they're getting very, very long. So please keep them short and to the point and on topic. Panel at WAMC.org is how you should address them. We will continue our discussion right after this short break.
Good morning, listening to the music of John Beasley this morning. You can see the playlist posted online, wamc.org/roundtable. By the way, I want to tell you about a concert that's coming up at the Guthrie Center this Friday and Saturday. It's the Urban Renewal Concert, returning to the Guthrie Center, featuring the music of Tower of Power, Stevie Wonder, Earth, Wind & Fire, Aretha Franklin, Sly and the Family Stones. All of this happening on Friday and Saturday at 8 o'clock. You can find out more. Hey, they even serve dinner, I think.
And all the money is going to the Guthrie Center, which is great.
Excellent. So this is Friday and Saturday, 8 o'clock. You can find out more by going to GuthrieCenter.org, GuthrieCenter.org. All right. Yes. Let us go to, I think I have letters. Yeah, here. Judy says, I must disagree with the esteemed Malcolm Nance on this one. I think the fellow sentenced to 8 months in prison for breaching the Capitol should have gotten many more. And the fact that he cannot legally own a firearm again doesn't mean much. He can, of course, illegally own a firearm.
Yeah, well, I agree with you. Come on, yeah, give him, I think he should have gotten the maximum for what he did. I mean, he really did just wander into the building, but I want to see 200 of these convictions. I want to see real convictions. But again, for those of you who don't study the right-wing world, and I've been fully immersed in it in for certainly the last 6 years.
You do it. You take, do it so we don't have to.
Taking to, oh, my gosh. I don't know if I've ever mentioned the name of my new book that's coming out this fall.
Never.
But it's called it's called They Want to Kill Americans. And it is about American citizens here who don't view half this nation as people. And they have no problem using the belief that terrorism and firearms and paramilitary action is the way our next generation's going. So taking away their legal right to own a firearm, which means if they go into a Chuck E. Cheese's or they go into a 7-Eleven and they've got a concealed carry pistol, the police will arrest you and you will go back. You will go to prison for real time.
Now, do you think, Malcolm, that these people, as they get convicted and sent off to jail, are just going to become heroes to the right, the ultra-right, and that may actually backfire?
Yeah, too many of them. How many heroes can you have? I mean, they're not going to have a pantheon of the Great Revolution. They're trying that with Ashley Babbitt, the Air Force veteran, senior airman that was shot to death. The one person in all of the Capitol who literally guarded red lines on aircraft where you could use lethal force, who should have known better. But it's not happening. They view only Donald Trump as I'm going to use the phrase they use, God Emperor of the United States.
Ouch.
It's true. Look it up.
And it's Americans who tried to kidnap the governor of Michigan recently. Let's not forget.
Interestingly, was Plan B. Plan A was they were going to take 200 armed men and storm the Capitol in Michigan, and they were going to release all the Republicans and policemen and try and execute all the Democrats through hanging out the windows of the State House. They just couldn't get enough guys interested. So they decided to kidnap, try, and execute the governor. This stuff is happening, and we're not seeing it, but it's happening.
We have about 10 minutes left, so I want to get to this story because I find it fascinating. About 20 minutes ago, I asked people in this room, our panelists, if they would go up into space like Jeff Bezos did. So now I want to know how many of you would go to the Olympics.
Nope.
I'd go to the Olympics. I'm vaccinated, y'all. So,
but does that matter?
And I wear a mask.
Know. Is it either or? In other words, I wouldn't go up into space.
No, it's separate. It's separate. No, completely separate. So the Olympics are going on. The New York Times has a great, article that just says, are the Olympics worth it? We look at all the money that is spent. We look at all that is happening. We look at where we are right now as far as the troubles. Many American athletes have tested positive. Boggles my mind that vaccinations are not mandatory going into the Olympics. I think it's 78% of athletes are vaccinated. There are all kinds of cases that are coming out, but they're going into an area that is in a state of emergency in Tokyo, Japan, where I think the vaccination rate is only around 18 to 20%. I don't know. And so I think
The New York Times article asks a valid question: are the Olympics worth it? Not just in this case during a pandemic, but overall of what they do and the massive amounts and gobs of money that are spent on them.
Well, to NBC, they are sure worth it. It makes a lot of people a lot of money. And that, I think, is the drive. I mean, there's a parallel drive of people wanting to honor excellence and compete. But I think it has just become so commercial. I remember 1980 when we had the Winter Olympics in Lake Placid. It was the last little Olympics, the last time that big corporations didn't run the whole thing and turn it into just a made-for-television event. And even that was a made-for-television event, but at a much lower scale. I think it's just gotten out of hand, and all the wonderful things of the Olympics that they are and still can be are so diminished by the takeover by the money people.
Sir?
Go ahead. Why do they make so much money? Because everybody enjoys them. You know,
it's good TV.
It's great TV. My only comment.
They appeal to every man too. You know, like one day you're Joe the plumber, and the next day you're on the national stage throwing a hammer that no one really knew was something that you could do.
Well, as an African American, I'm going to put a pitch in here for our community. It's only in the last two Olympics have we seen these breakout stars in non-traditional areas, like Simone Biles, who we all know no one had any clue of until she started just destroying the global, you know, stage in gymnastics. And I think she just popped positive, right? I think she has been exposed.
The gymnastics team was.
The gymnastics team.
And because so one of the alternates.
We'll see whether she goes. And you know, I love that. I mean, she really started bringing me back. You might recall, what was it, the Muslim American fencer who, you know, my wife used to fence, and in the Navy, I carried a cutlass. So I just like the whole idea of that swashbuckling. And she's gold medal. I mean, she is world class. So you get all these new things, you know. Everyone is the Jamaican bobsled team now, okay? Whoa. There are all these breakout characters, and I like watching that. I like seeing these come-up stories.
But is it worth putting kids in danger for?
Well, no. I mean, we're in a global pandemic. The whole world is in danger. They should have canceled this Olympics or pushed it back to next year.
Then it would run into the Winter Olympics in China next year.
It is
something that is different than what we usually see on television, which what we usually get from the media is a lot of divisiveness and the world is burning. And this is an uplifting thing where you see stories of people that can come from anywhere to excel and be competitive.
The best of times.
Yes, in the best of times, yes.
Yeah. But we need those stories even more so in the worst of times. Storytelling right now is experiencing a lot of resurgence because people want to hear good news. We've been sitting in our living spaces consuming information for over a year and a half, and a lot of it hasn't been positive. And the Olympics have historically been a place where we get these rah-rah feel-good moments. Mm-hmm. And that's what's...
But at what cost, though? I mean, it's bankrupted countries. The facilities in Brazil are already falling down. I mean, they didn't have any use after the Olympics. There's got to be a smarter, better way to do it that doesn't require everybody who hosts the Olympics going bankrupt.
Agree 100%.
Putting all of that money forward. And, I mean, all of these stadiums are being built, and there's nobody going to be in them in Tokyo. We're going to have an opening ceremonies with no spectators.
Right. And all those, but it's the feel-good moments that give us that shot that we need in our brain of adrenaline or whatever the feel-good hormones are that allows them to do this and to sell us things while they do it. Tide Pods become your next detergent, and you don't know why. Like, why am I drawn?
Official detergent of the Tokyo Olympics.
And no one forced Brazil to take on the Olympics. They spent hundreds of millions of dollars. They wanted the Olympics. You know, all these countries want the Olympics. They want the honor of their country to host the world and show the world what
they're
about.
But we enabled it. I mean, the Olympic committee enabled it by letting Brazil spend billions of dollars, which has so much poverty.
Yeah.
And they spend billions of dollars on stadiums they're not even going to use after
the
game.
And who built the stadiums?
Yeah.
Sure.
The Brazilians.
But case in point about that, I remembered the feel-good story about the fencer. I completely forgot she did it at the Brazil Olympics. I completely forgot they had an Olympics.
Right. Can't there be a way? I mean, there's constantly talk about having only a few cities around the globe where you keep it.
Do it all in Greece.
Yeah, or something like that. Yeah.
You're right, Joe. That's what
Greece and Switzerland or something. I mean, it denies all the other countries the honors and all that. I mean, it's a complicated mess, and I don't see it being
resolved.
Well,
England only gets Wimbledon. We get the World Series. I mean, you know, come on.
And it is, I agree with you, Mike, it is historically extremely corrupt how these countries get the Olympics to
because of the amount of money. I mean, it didn't used to be that way.
Right.
Yeah.
And now I have to wonder. I'm about to enter into the record a thought that I have not vetted or thought of too much, but it just popped into my head.
That's dangerous.
Which is always dangerous to do. But I wonder. This just occurred to me. But it will, given the idea that so many of these young athletes come out of a college system, an NCAA system, now that that has changed and those athletes can receive compensation prior, is that going to change the playing field? I mean, are we going to have those feel-good stories as much anymore when the kid who comes into the Olympics is already making a couple million dollars?
Well, I hope Simone Biles does. I mean, UCLA is pushing her YouTube videos constantly, right? So, like, we get those feel-good stories more often with her, and she should be compensated for that.
Professionals are now allowed. You know, when they started having NBA players in the Olympics.
The dream team, didn't win, by the way.
The belief of amateurism went completely out the window. Let them earn their ducats.
Well, I agree. Let them earn their money. I'm just wondering, as coming into it, you know, are you going to see as many of the feel-good stories of the kid coming out of nowhere when there's money at stake?
What I love about the Olympics is you never really know what sport it is that is going to capture the imagination of the media and the fans. And
I'll tell you, equestrian.
Well,
Young Ms. Springsteen might
That's
get a gold
right.
medal.
Exactly, Mike. Exactly.
Absolutely.
That's the one I can't wait to watch. Go ahead.
I ride. I'm a dressage fan.
Yeah, I mean, but you're right. We don't know. We don't know.
Yeah, and you just have to watch. And I'm a fan. I think that it now whether the return on investment, it's hard to say whether it's worth the money or it's worth whatever. But I think I'm a fan, and it will be different without fans. It is not fun to watch live sports without
fans.
I know.
To see someone do an incredible gymnastics feat. Land on their feet and know.
Right.
You know,
right.
You made the point earlier about, we spent all this money, but we watch it. And we do. And it is fascinating. We'll be talking about it over the next several weeks about what goes on day to day at the Olympics, which is fascinating. And I think that's very cool. I just wonder, Mike, if NBC, which from my understanding, and maybe this has changed, but from my understanding, offers the pool feed to other international.
I think they're required to as part of their contract with the
right.
Olympic Committee.
So if they had said, let's talk about the power of the media for a second.
Right.
If they had said, yeah, this doesn't seem safe, let's wait.
Well, yeah, they would have had been a major influencer, but they are also
would have given up the money, right?
Yeah, I mean they're a business, right? So they're going to do what they know will make money, and there's a valid reason. We all need the diversion. We need to see excellence. I was enjoying the European Cup finals a couple of weeks ago. You know, depending on your sport. I mean, we all need that kind of thing, wherever we can get it, but. You know, it comes at a cost. And right now in Tokyo, when physicians and everybody in public health have been begging them not to have it for months, you can see maybe they were right.
All right. Well, that is that will end us this morning. My thanks to everybody. Alan, thank you very much.
Thanks, Joe. It's great to see all these people here.
Yes. Sarah Rogerson, thank you very much
this
for coming 2 days in a row. I really love having you here.
Yeah, you're great.
We'll see you tomorrow. JP Miller, thank you very much. Malcolm, thank you for being here. You're absolutely right. We were wrong.
Okay,
so I thank you very much for coming in as directed. And we'll make sure we get our calendar right. Mike Spain, thank you. Always good to see you. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
We'll be right back after this.